Welcome to the Unfiltered Podcast with me, Joe Warner, and powered by Ultimate Performance, the world's premier personal training experience that delivers maximum results in minimum time. In each episode of the Unfiltered Podcast, I interview the most respected, celebrated, and controversial experts in the fields of health, fitness, nutrition, well-being, and performance to help you find the life-changing advice you need to live smarter. Remember, you can find all of our exclusive Unfiltered documentaries, video interviews, and investigations at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. And now, on with the show. Mike, you've been a covert counter-terrorism operative. You've been an endurance athlete, the fastest Briton to solo row the Atlantic, and now you're an entrepreneur who helps men navigate the second half of their life. This is like Christmas morning for me, right? I've wrestled with where I want to dive in and start picking your brains. But it struck me that they seem like three very separate career chapters from the outside. But are there any kind of common themes or challenges that run like a seam through your career so far?
I think your chapters is a really good way to put it, Joe. I started off in the Royal Marines, so, and I was fortunate enough, well, you might say fortunate, to be in commando training when 9/11 happened. So in the aftermath of 9/11, if we all remember that point of time, we were the first conventional British troops to go to Afghanistan. So I experienced operational warfare quite young. And then I led Marines to war in Iraq the following year and then Northern Ireland. So within 3 years, in my early 20s, I'd got this wealth of experience of understanding, I suppose, the importance of mission and the importance of kind of leadership and team. And then from there, transferred, as you say, into the covert world of the Ministry of Defence, where I spent 15 years working, running surveillance teams, running covert agents, working undercover, all that kind of good stuff. And that happened in the aftermath of 7/7. So again, the busiest period of operational activity I was fortunate to be a part of. And then I'm not the fastest Briton ever to row solo across the Atlantic, but I am the fastest Briton to have rowed the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge solo, 3,000 miles. And then since then, I've started my own businesses. And I think the theme that runs through all of those, and it was the greatest lesson from the ocean, and it's a great place to start, is that nothing good happens alone. We kid ourselves in thinking that we can do it on our own. We can do this. You can't do it on your own. You can't hope to affect a positive outcome in a military operation alone. You can't hope to even, you know, recruit a covert agent, which would be you and me, without a team behind you. You can't row an ocean solo super fast without coaches and nutritionists and support and sponsors. And you certainly can't start a business on your own. And you can't scale it on your own. So I think that's the thing that is the thread that runs through everything, Joe, is that we have to do things together as humans.
I'm going to throw all of my questions out the window then, because everything I was going to ask you is around resilience and leadership. But am I missing the bigger picture? Is it teamwork? Is that the thing that unifies everything you've done and maybe where a lot of men are maybe going wrong?
It's trust, I think, Joe. You know, more than teamwork. I mean, you know, you don't have team without trust. But in order to have trust in an organization, within a relationship, a friendship, you need to be vulnerable enough to be honest about the way that you feel and have enough empathy to understand the other person's point of view. And if we have that, you know, one of the commando qualities, of which there are four: courage, determination, cheerfulness in the face of adversity, or laughing when it's shit. The fourth one is unselfishness. And it's such an important one. Probably I'd argue the most important. It's those unselfish behaviors. It's thinking about others first that really helps create that trust. And there's a great saying from an American general that trust is tempo. And I think when I think about that, and when I started my businesses in lockdown, having resigned from the MOD, well, I know we're going to talk about Next 45 in a moment, but that was the one thing that I saw men really struggling with, was their ability to be open and to be honest about actually how they felt. I felt different at 40. I cried every day on the ocean. And I made sure I shared that because I wanted people to see this guy who's done all this stuff is still, you know, struggling like everyone else.
Is it possible to describe, you mentioned just some key words from your military career. I think for somebody like me, who only ever has any experience of the military through dramatization, it's TV, it's movies, right? Or it's ex-personnel coming back and telling their story. Is it possible to sum up
your career in three or five words, just to try and get a sense of what it must have been like. And I appreciate that's an incredible, I don't want to be dismissive or simplify it, but are there any words that spring to mind?
I mean, I think again, brotherhood, you know, community is absolutely key. That's the one thing, that's the reason I joined the Marines. You know, my dad left when I was 10. I had no kind of father figure. I had no one guiding me in life. I made some bad decisions in my teens, took a lot of drugs, drank a lot of booze, got arrested. And I was searching for a brotherhood, a group of people, a tribe, whatever you want to say, to connect to. Again, I think that's the first word that springs to mind, brotherhood. I think mission is super important. Whatever you do in life, you've got to have a purpose. If you have a really strong purpose, a really strong North Star, pretty much anything is possible. So I'm going to stop at those two. I think a brotherhood, a community, doing things together and having a clear mission is the two things that really kind of help set the platform for high performance.
You've touched on a number of things I really want to come back and explore in greater detail around kind of men, brotherhood, young men's place in society today, toxic masculinity, all those kind of hot topics. But before we get there, Mike, can you tell me, is there any particular moment or memory from your military career that is something you think about regularly, that is something you've carried with you into your endurance athlete career or your entrepreneurship? Is there any kind of standout moments that is something, it's almost like your anchor point, for lack of a better phrase?
Yeah, I suppose the one I would pick out, it wasn't as a Royal Marine, it was as a recruit. So 30 weeks of commando training, hardest, longest basic military training in the world. And I was flying. Week 15, I was awarded the Craig Medal. It was the best recruit in the troop halfway through training. Doing really, really well. And then 7 weeks later, it was our bottom field pass out. And you've got to do four things. You've got to climb a 30-foot rope outside with 30-pound of kit on and your rifle. You've got to do an assault course under 5 minutes. Carry a mate for 200 metres under 90 seconds and then hang off a rope and get back on top without falling in the water, right? It's called a regain. And I could do everything in training, but I could not climb that rope. And you get three attempts to stay in your troop with your mates. That was the best guy in there. And I failed all three. And I had to leave that friendship group that I'd created, that brotherhood, and go and rehabilitate because I fell off the rope 20 foot up on my last attempt. And then you get three more attempts to stay in the Royal Marines. And if you don't pass those three, you're gone. And I failed the first two. And I remember stood at the bottom of this rope and the PTI, the physical training instructor, came over and he said, look, forget everything that's happened. I just want you to close your eyes. Don't think about anything else. Get on this rope and just climb until your head hits the stanchion that's holding off the floor. And that's what I did, mate. I just climbed for what felt like hours, just eyes closed, one more little shift, one more little shift, one more little movement. And I inched my way up this rope and I actually did it. And that was the moment for me. You know, we talk ourselves out of being able to do lots of things in life. I've got a phrase, live a life without limits. That's what I want people to believe, because you can do anything you want. And I'm nothing special, mate. I'm from kid from Doncaster, handful of GCSEs, no A-levels, no degree. But I've seen to have achieved certain things in my life, and it's just because I believe in myself and I don't talk myself out of it. And that was the moment that I thought, wow, I can do anything provided I've got this in the right space.
Is that self-belief inherent? Have you always had it? Or is it something that started as a kernel that you've had to nurture and grow?
It's a craft. Same is resilience is the same. You know, I have this system I call the wall of evidence. And the way I kind of try and envisage resilience or self-belief is that it is a constant process through life. And every time you set yourself a goal that's just slightly beyond your grasp, something that you're not quite sure if you're able to achieve, and you attempt it, you may even fail, but at least you've attempted it in your best possible way. You give it your best shot. Have no regrets. Every time you do that, you put another brick in the wall. And this wall gets higher and higher and bigger and stronger. And it becomes a fortress of self-belief. Because the question I get asked the most when I speak for businesses and sports teams nowadays is, like, how do you cope with that 40-foot wave in the dead of night in the Atlantic? How do you cope with the Taliban waiting for you in Afghanistan or that agent that wants to take your life? And the truth is, you don't know how you're going to cope. And we don't know how we're going to cope with life, because it's going to throw us some curveballs, right? And so we need to have this wall of evidence behind us that we can look and say, oh, do you know what? I think I'm capable of this. That's where self-belief comes from. You can't read it in a book. You can't learn it. You're not born with it. You develop it over time.
You have a unique perspective on leadership and resilience, given your career, specifically with the military and then the endurance athlete work you've done. What are some of the unconventional tips and advice you've had? Because resilience is such a hot topic, a buzzword, right? Everyone wants to be a bit more resilient because the world's a tough place right now. Have you got any unconventional lessons or any unconventional tips that is kind of atypical to the advice that you see put out there by a lot of other people?
Well, I think I would say there's no secret sauce. There's no silver bullet to success and resilience. I think, controversial as it may sound, you've got to embrace failure. You've got to actively kind of almost seek it, because you want to be pushing, in my opinion, as I say, past the end of your grasp into that grey zone that you're not sure whether or not you're going to be able to do it. Most people stick within what they believe is capable within them. And I think the way to build true resilience is to stretch yourself. Like, you know, setting off on that first oar stroke to row 3,000 miles, 4 million oar strokes across the Atlantic Ocean, not knowing what the weather was going to do, disconnected from my family over Christmas. Like, I had no idea whether I'd make it or not. All I knew I could do was prepare like my life depended on it. And I did that, Joe. I made sure I prepared really well. But I think far too many of us avoid feedback. And I'd say feedback is a gift. So, you know, ask people, how am I doing? Am I good at this? Am I bad at this? You know, how can I improve? And don't worry about failure. Actually look for it and embrace it. Push the boundaries of what you're capable of and you'll unlock your hidden potential.
So how does someone start there, Mike? Because when you getting out of your comfort zone isn't like me getting out of my comfort zone and maybe joining a Spanish class. Do you know what I mean? The potential of something going wrong isn't just, oh, I failed. It could be the end of your life. How do you get in that mindset? And how can people watching this who just want to do something a little bit braver, how do you start? How do you begin? Does it all come from that confidence, that self-belief? Or are there other ways that people can almost kind of trick themselves into beginning?
Like I said, it's a craft, mate. There's no trick. There's no, you know, silver bullet to this. I think the way to do it, it's all relative, right? Like if you're starting... if you've not trained physically for a long, long time, you know, a couch to 5K might be like way beyond your grasp. And that might be the place to start. If you've trained for 30 years and you've achieved some stuff, you might want to go row across an ocean. It's the same thing, really. One's not better than the other. It's all relative. And so I would say start small. I'd say, you know, just incremental increase in your ability and your self-confidence over time is absolutely key. Don't, you know, go from not having trained for years to rowing an ocean. That's too big of a jump. You know, you're guaranteed failure there. So you've got to accept you need to build up to this. But I think it's all relative, mate. No one's better than anyone else. It's just what you've been used to.
Talk to me about the ocean row, because I think a lot of people watching this will just maybe naively or innocently think of it as a physical challenge. But is it a mental challenge? Or where is the ratio between the physical and the mental determination or capacity needed?
I mean, certainly it's different as a soloist to a team. I think it's probably, in my estimation, 99% mental and 1% physical. The physical aspect of it is, it's like a long, slow walk uphill, but every day, all day, for 4 to 6 days, right? So it's not, you're never out of breath. You're kind of, you know, you're within kind of a zone two level of physical output. But the mental challenge of the ocean, specifically alone, is the thing that is most difficult, mate. Like I said to my wife before I left, I said, I'll call you twice a week. I want to enjoy the solitude. Everyone said, enjoy the solitude and the silence. Disconnect from the noise. It's going to be great. Man, I called her twice a day every day, crying my eyes out. Just desperately lonely, desperately longing for that human connection we spoke about. You know, I was speaking to anything that moved, like a bird that would fly past and have a full conversation with it, a fish, the moon, the stars, the sun, because as human beings, it's an innate thing that we want to connect with others. We've only ever evolved well when we've been with groups of people. You know, I can make a fire, you can kill a woolly mammoth, let's share some of that meat and I'll show you how to cook it. That's the way we've done it, right? Again, it comes back to that point of nothing good happens alone. So I think that absolutely is a mental challenge. I think it is different in a team. You know, if you've got another 3-4 people on the boat, physically, perhaps less arduous, and also way easier in terms of your mental state, because you at least have someone to say, man, I'm feeling crap today. How are you feeling?
In terms of preparation, obviously you left no stone unturned, but I imagine there must be some mental challenges you can't prepare for because you can't necessarily imagine them. Was there anything that stands out as something that completely took you by surprise? And if so, how did you deal with it?
Yeah, two things. The first one, just going back to the previous point, really, is that you can't prepare for that solitude. People, when they row the ocean, and I did the same, go away to the Lake District in Abothy for 3 days and think that's going to somehow simulate being alone. When you know in 3 days' time, you're going to be stopping at the services and getting a pork pie or whatever. So that's the big one, really, is that you can't prepare for the solitude. The sleep deprivation, obviously, you can't prepare for that. I was rowing anywhere between 14 and 17 hours a day in kind of one big block with little breaks for food. And then I'd try and get about 4 hours sleep. But it was broken, very light sleep. So I think that was something else that you can't really prepare for. And the final thing really, mate, is, and I only discovered this at the very end. So what happened was I was heading towards Antigua. I was 35 nautical miles off. I was going to be the first solo in. I beat the next person in my division or my class by a week. So I was way ahead. And the weather started to turn and push me south. And the short story is that I couldn't row into Antigua at that current time. So I rang the safety officer and he said, you've got to just go on to parachute anchor. Just kind of like hold the boat where it is, have some rest. Everyone else is on parachute anchor. Don't worry about it. I just had this feeling like I knew my family were 30 miles away, Joe. And I was like, I've got to see him again. So I said, I ain't going on parachute anchor, mate. He's like, well, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to row nonstop until I get there. He said, it's going to take you a day. I said, yeah, I know. So I rowed for 22 hours straight to get into Antigua. In the final 7 hours, I said about it, you know, not being out of breath, the final 7 hours was a maximum effort row to get into the coastline and round. So that showed me that we're capable of way more than we think, man. Way more, when the motivation is deep enough.
I want to speak about motivation, how someone can find their purpose. But there's two things about the row that I'd just really like to pick your brains on. The first is time. Tell me about time, because so many of us spend most of our working week rushing around from meeting to meeting, kids, other responsibilities. Did time fundamentally change for you on that row? Because you've got this open expanse of ocean, there's no one to speak to. Obviously, you know what time it is, but does time move slowly? Does it move quickly? Can you give me your kind of how your perception of time worked?
Yeah, you start to become really connected to the daylight and really connected to the weather. You become almost feral and part of the environment that you're living in. So, you know, I didn't wear a watch. I didn't know what time it was, but I knew what time it was by where the sun was in the sky, right? And how hot it felt. And I knew I needed to sleep when it was dark and things like that. So that distortion of time, I suppose, you just get connected to it. But no, there's no, it felt, to, there's two things, man. So it felt like there was no time at all. This time didn't really matter. I could do what I wanted when I wanted. But then I'd set myself standards. So, you know, I'd set myself that I was going to get up at 5 o'clock every morning when it was still dark and go out onto the deck and start rowing for 6 hours. And then I'd say, well, I'm going to break for lunch at 10. I'm going to break for dinner at 6. And I would be quite disciplined with that because I think you need that structure. If it's too loose, like you can go onto the ocean, man. There was people in that year, it took 120 days to get across. They're just floating across. It's like they're just on a lilo, just floating. You're not doing much rowing. And that's absolutely fine if that's what you want to do. No criticisms at all. But for them, time mattered not at all because they weren't doing anything. For me, I wanted to get across as quick as I could. So actual time, really irrelevant. But I had the discipline to make sure that I lived up to those standards that I'd set myself.
And speaking of living, the other thing I want to touch upon was death, because you've risked life and limb for significant chunks of your adult life. Are you scared by the prospect of death, or in your line of work, is it something that just becomes an accepted odd that you factor into your preparation?
Yeah, I don't think you think about it much when you're young. I don't remember thinking of my mortality when I was in my 20s or in my teens in the Royal Marines and in the MOD. Certainly something I've thought a lot more about when I've got older. It's kind of one of the reasons why Next 45 was born, really, because, you know, I just want more than anything else, Joe, what I'd say to anyone listening, it's like, at some point, you're going to run out of time. We don't know when that's going to be. It could be in 4 years' time, 45 years' time, it could be 5 years' time, 5 minutes' time, we don't know. When you take your last breath, don't have any regrets. Live the life you want to live. And you've got a chance right now to write the narrative of what that life looks like. You get to choose how you live those years and what people say about you in the church when you're gone. But far too many people don't think about that. They just kind of drift through life and then they blink, they're 60, 70 years old, and they're like, man, I wish I'd have done this. I wish I'd cared less about what people thought about me. I wish I'd taken a few more risks. So I'm a bit more in tune with that mortality at the moment, but I think for me, it just drives me to keep pushing and keep experiencing life.
Turning to Next 45 now, talk to me about the genesis. Was there a lightning bolt moment where you decided this is what you wanted to do? Or was it more the culmination of everything you'd been through over the previous 15 or 20 years that led you to the conclusion that, I guess, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but, you know, men were lost. Men were living with regrets and needn't do so.
Yeah, it's a good question, mate. So, you know, at 40 years old, I'd served our country for 20 years. So half of my entire life, I've been in service to keeping the country safe. And then lockdown happened and everyone was worried about the jobs, right? But I got this sense that I wanted to row across this ocean, and I rowed across the ocean primarily to raise money for charity, for the hospital unit that saved my youngest son's life. So I had a really strong pull towards doing that. And I decided to resign from the MOD because they wouldn't support the row. And when I resigned and gave up that 20-year career and the pension and everything else to just see what that life without limits looks like, I was mindful that I felt a bit different and I felt a bit lonely. You know, what they don't tell you in the military and in the MOD is that when you leave, you don't really stay in touch with people. You might have a few mates on Facebook, but you're not part of the gang anymore. And life moves on. And I was kind of stuck at home thinking, man, I feel a bit crappier. And then I started to think, well, but I've achieved all this stuff. I've done loads of stuff. What about everyone else? So I just started to look into the statistics around mental health. I wasn't feeling in any way suicidal. I wasn't feeling depressed. I was just felt a bit lost. And I was absolutely staggered by some of the statistics that I was reading. And then I started to think, when was the last time we had a conversation about men? There's been conversations around toxic masculinity, but that's not about men. That's about a problem in society. But we've had great conversations around feminism and race and gender and equality and all that good stuff. We've made huge progress in all those areas. But at no point yet, still today, Joe, have we had a societal conversation about what it is to be a guy, all the challenges that men face specifically to us. And then I read a book called The Second Mountain by David Brooks. And it was almost like he'd written the book for me. It was everything that I was thinking at that time. And I'd encourage anyone to read it who's kind of navigating that midlife piece. And so the first business I registered was Next 45, NXT 45. But I knew that I didn't have all the skills necessary to help all men. So I approached two really good friends and jiu-jitsu students of mine, actually. One is an ex-professional rugby league player and a specialist in health transformation, physical fitness and nutrition. And one is a former multi-billion pound CEO turned stage one trained health psychologist. So I tried to build this little team and then we co-founded Next 45 together. And I think that was really important we did that, because we now believe that we have the necessary skills, the broad range of skills that you need to help men. But that's how it started. And we've only been going for a year. It's been in my mind for about 5 years, but we've only actually been going for a year. We delivered our first flagship event last year in September, the 100, my Next 45, which was amazing. And when I told people I was going to put 100 men in a field with no booze, no women, ice baths, yoga, breath work, fire cooked food, group workouts in a castle, paddle boarding, wild swimming, everyone thought I'd gone mad. They said, mate, no one's going to come. But they did come. And it changed people's lives.
So why do you think the conversation around men's health, specifically men's mental health, still isn't happening? Because if you look, as you have done, at the statistics around leading causes of death of men of certain age, it's suicide. Why do you think the conversation's not happening?
I mean, when we started last year, 3 out of every 4 people who killed themselves were men. within a year, it's now 4 out of 5. So the trend's getting worse. And there's loads of statistics around young boys as well. So it's not just middle-aged men, but, you know, young males who grow up without a father figure. And they're 50% less likely to succeed at school. 76% of people in custody have grown up in a fatherless home. So I think the reason why we haven't had that societal conversation is men are expected just to get on with it. Man up. Stop moaning. There's this kind of like societal pressure just to be okay and have it nailed and protect and provide. And we haven't got past that yet. And one of the challenges for men is that we just don't talk enough. We're not honest enough and vulnerable enough about the way that we feel. Because when we show that vulnerability, we naturally feel shame. Because I'm not a real man. And I suppose what we're trying to do in Next 45 is say that vulnerability is your real strength. That's the greatest strength you can have. If you can be open and honest to the world about who you really are and how you feel, there's no strength greater than that. So I think that's the challenge at the moment, is getting men to speak. And they're not talking, mate. They're engaging in risk behaviours to mask how they really feel. So they're drinking and they're taking drugs and they're gambling and looking at porn. And we're trying to find new ways with Next 45 to help men navigate that process.
Given your vantage point, are you positive about the trend of men's health, or are you not so positive? So I'm interested, just given your perspective, where you think the abundance of education, resource, technology, there's a lot happening that could move conversations forward in the right direction. But what's your, from your viewpoint, are you positive or not about the future?
I'm a positive person, Joe, so I'd like to think we can make a difference. And I'd like to think Next 45 will be in some way able to start or change a conversation around men's health. But honestly, the statistics are going in the wrong direction, mate. It's not looking good. I have noticed since the kind of genesis of Next 45, as you put it, that there has been a little bit of a change. So you've got kind of big people with platforms like Joe Rogan speaking about this kind of stuff, Chris Williamson speaking about this kind of stuff. You're speaking about it. The BBC have done some stuff around what it is to be a man. So that we're starting to have that conversation. But it takes, of course, men to engage in it. We can push information out all the time. And we do that at Next 45. We send a free newsletter out every week with insights and tips and tools to try and help, you know, become a better person. But you need that person to want to engage in it. And I think we're going to, you know, you're trying to undo millennia of men being the provider, protector. You've got to nail it. You've got to get it right. And that's going to take a while.
Well, for every positive male role model with a platform, there's inevitably going to be somebody who maybe isn't a positive role model. And, you know, Andrew Tate is the name that springs to mind as someone who I think personally has found a huge audience by being a role model, you know, telling men what their place is in society, especially young men, because they don't know. They're confused by this toxic masculinity backlash. They don't know their role in society. They feel like their natural urges and feelings are somehow bad. How do we begin to combat the likes of the TikTok generation in terms of them getting their information from people who do not have their best interests at heart?
I think it's got to start at home, hasn't it? You know, every child has a father. And so our message in Next 45 is that, you know, when men live happier, healthier, more fulfilled lives, everyone wins. And that means you're better fathers, you're better leaders, you're better partners, better friends. So I think if we can create this understanding of men, of the responsibility as a father, to really help guide those young people, because people who are listening to Andrew Tate, it's because they've got no one to listen to in the real world. And they're looking for someone to tell them what to do. It's why I joined the Royal Marines, as I said at the beginning. So I think if we can try and create this movement within men to become really good, positive male role models, I think that will make a huge difference, because you can't stop the TikTok generation, mate. You can't stop the internet. It's not going to happen. What we can do is start to add that positivity into our young people from home, I think. That's what I try and do with my boys.
We've talked about some of the negative or the challenges. What about the positives? What about the bright sparks? Where are you most encouraged that we can move the needle in the right direction, Mike?
Oh, mate, we've seen it. We've seen it within our community already. You know, people who came to the 100 last year, the feedback was, and you can see this on our Instagram and our YouTube channel, that it was a life-changing event. And we've seen guys within that period from September last year to now, you know, lose 3 stone or spend more time with the kids or work less or whatever it is they need to do, because it's different for everybody, isn't it? So I think there's some real positives there. We've got a phenomenal little community in Next 45 that we're nurturing, and each one of those individuals is a real champion. And I think it's that kind of ripple effect that we're looking for here. It's not going to be a big splash front page news, let's have a chat about men and we start to have it. It's these conversations we're having today, mate, and someone listening to it, it resonates with them, and then they go and tell someone else. I think that's really how it's going to work.
I want to ask you a quick two-parter, Michael. It might not be quick, depending on how deep we go into it. What's your advice for men of our age who are feeling a little bit lost? You know, they've got the responsibility of, you know, providing for their family. They might have young kids and elderly parents to take care of. They're trying to navigate this transition that you went through. So that's one thing. Where did these guys begin in terms of improving both their mental and physical health? And then the follow-up to that, what's your advice to younger guys? You know, if you could go back, although to be honest, you going back and talking to your 16-year-old self, probably, you know, you did the right thing anyway. But what about advice for younger guys who are trying to navigate this maze that is manhood in the 21st century? Where should they look for advice and support?
Well, to your first point, I think the middle-aged man is undergoing a transition between their first and their second adult life. David Brooks has said in The Second Mountain really articulates this well, insofar as he views life as being two mountains. The first mountain we summit within the first 35 years of our life as men tends to be centered around success and power and status and wealth, and rightly so. Like, I'm not here to tell, you know, men they shouldn't be ambitious. Like, go do that stuff. But if you stay on that climb for too long, the rewards start to become less and less important. And the view starts to change. And so what tends to happen is we come off that first mountain into the valley between the two. And that is the archetypal midlife crisis, mate. That's where people are lost. They're lost in the valley, in the jungle at the bottom. They can't find the way out. And what we're trying to do at Next 45 is get people onto the second mountain. Because the second mountain is all about fulfillment and fatherhood and positive relationships and self-care and vulnerability. And I think those are the things we should be aiming for in the second half of our life, mentoring other people, helping other people get better themselves. That's where the real currency is in life, I believe, is helping others. So getting onto that second mountain is really important. And for the young people, and for the middle-aged guys as well, I'd say just stop for a moment and just think about what you want your life to be at the end. When you turn back around and you look at the last 90 years, 100 years, what do you want to have achieved? What do you want people to say about you in the church? If you want them to say you were a good dad and a loving family man, spend some more time with your kids. Stop going to work every day. You know, it might be that you want them to say that he was a successful business founder and entrepreneur. Great, go work more. But you've got to make sure you're looking ahead. And it's unique to everybody. Everyone's got their own view of how they want their life to live. But far too many of us, young and old, don't even think about it.
You strike me as someone who's always had a sense of purpose, but for a lot of men, both young guys and guys in that midlife valley, purpose is something that they've probably not even considered, let alone know how to find. What's your advice for someone? How does somebody find their why, Mike?
I think you need to, again, stop for a moment. And I do an exercise with people when I do workshops on this about understanding who you are first. So you've got to understand who you are. And so I'd say, like, what are your top 5 values? What do you value the most in life in terms of behaviors? What are your top 5 anti-values? What are the things you hate in other people? What about the virtues that you try and purvey into the world and those behaviors? And then the difference between resume virtues and eulogy virtues. You know, what do people say about you at work? What do they say about you at home and in that church that I talk about? So I think it's really important to look inward and have a period of self-reflection. Again, talked about the young people here. There's far too much noise and influence coming in that we rarely stop to think about, like, well, what do I actually believe? What do I actually think? And then just follow that path. And I think in terms of purpose, it's finding that deeper why. It has to be intrinsic. I worry for my kids because a lot of their motivation is extrinsic. They're going to put it on Snapchat. They want to put it on Instagram. The mates want to say this about them. It's got to be a deep internal intrinsic why. Those motivations, and that might be to raise a loving family. That might be to help people in society. That's certainly my purpose in life, Joe. That's why I served 120 years. That's why I continue to try and serve in my businesses. It's helping others. And when you know that, every decision you make is quite simple.
Does it worry you that so many young people are seeking external validation at all costs over everything else? Because to me, I've spoken to a lot of experts around this subject, Mike. No one's got an answer. No one knows how to stop it. Aside from physically taking your phone away from your kids, how can we begin, focusing specifically on boys and young men here, how can we help them? Because their entire world is in the palm of their hand, and that's where they're seeking approval and validation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm no expert, so let's get that out on the table right now. You're not speaking to a psychologist, speak to Joe, our co-founder. What I would say is I think it's about self-worth. I think it's about children understanding that they are good enough for all their strengths and all their weaknesses and all their flaws and all their amazing attributes. They don't need to be anybody else. I have this challenge all the time, my youngest son, who continues to try and be someone else, be a character of himself, because he thinks that's what other people like about him. I'm like, just be you. The thing they like the most is you. So it starts again with parents and positive role models, particularly male role models for young boys. It's really important that, particularly in their formative years, they have, might not be a dad, but he could be a coach, he could be a teacher, he could be a friend, whatever, an uncle. Someone just to keep reaffirming that they are enough. And I think if we do that enough, we'll end up in a place where we're quite content.
Is this where sport, team sport, can be such a useful tool for young men? Not just because of the exercise, but that sense of brotherhood we mentioned at the start. It seems to me that's such an important part of finding your tribe, and a far less risky way than joining the military perhaps would be to join the sports team. Is that something you'd encourage?
Without a shadow of a doubt, mate. I mean, I run a jiu-jitsu academy, a Brazilian jiu-jitsu academy that I founded in lockdown as well. We've got 500 students training with us. 300 and odd students are under the age of 16. And the beautiful thing about Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and it's the same in rugby and it's the same in the military, is that it's the shared adversity that builds those bonds. That's really important. So, you know, we don't want to wrap our kids up in cotton wool. We need to give them a little bit of adversity. We need to show them that they're capable of more than they think. And when you do that with other people, it creates super strong bonds. So absolutely, team sports are key. Jiu-jitsu, people would say, is an individual sport or a martial art. I always say to my students that the moment you understand that jiu-jitsu isn't just about you, it's about your training partner, then that's when the magic happens. So yeah, absolutely, mate. We've got to surround our young people with other young people striving. We've got to give them a bit of adversity, make them struggle a little bit, and prove to themselves that they are capable more than they think.
The one thing I wanted to talk to you that strikes me as being such a huge part of men as they transition to the second half of their life is not something they can necessarily control. It's the menopause. It's their partner going through unbelievable life changes that most men, until they get to that point, can't even fathom. How important is that? Well, I've seen statistics around that, you know, the percentage of marriages that break down because of a lack of communication, the breakdown of trust. How important is it in your philosophy for men moving forward that they're better educated and can better support their partner? Because it might not directly be happening to them, but it's indirectly affecting every aspect of their lives.
Yeah, I think it is happening to them. I think, you know, testosterone drops, your strength, power drops after the age of about 40. And so hormonally, men are different in the second half of life. And that can leave us feeling a little bit kind of awful. Well, man, I used to be able to do this. Or I used to have, you know, my libido used to be like this and it's not anymore. And it's going to change for sure. So I think it's accepting that you will change as well. And again, that conversation, we haven't had that really. It's all been around TRT and, you know, but we've got to have a bit more of a broad conversation about that. On the menopause and on relationships, like I've learned that the most important thing in life is human connection. And the best human connection is between you and your partner. So nurturing those relationships and being there for your wife or your husband is so important. One thing that we do two things actually. So every Friday morning is scheduled in my diary, There's no meetings can happen because I go to the gym with my wife and we train together. We have a coffee or some lunch together. And we make sure we spend just a couple of hours, me and her, talking about how she feels and understanding where she's at that week. And then we train together on Sunday morning as well. We have this mantra that when you train together, you stay together. Again, it's that shared adversity. It's seeing the person that you love suffer and come through that builds that kind of trust. So I think men need to accept that they will change. You will feel different. Don't hide it. Don't start drinking more. Don't start trying to mask it. Go and figure out what's going on. Go to see your doctor and then carve out specific time. You know, if it's not in your calendar, it doesn't exist. So put it in your calendar. You're going out with your partner once a week for 2 hours just to be together. So important.
You mentioned TRT there, Mike. I'm really interested in your thoughts. I saw an interview with Dr. John Berardi, who was the founder of Precision Nutrition, who has this theory that lower testosterone levels in the middle part of a man's life helps them transition to this wise elder, where they exhibit a lot of the attributes you mentioned, you know, more patient, more understanding, more caring. Whereas a lot of the behavior you described in the first half of men's life, you know, the ambition, the power, could be described as testosterone driven traits, right? What's your take on TRT? Are men by following this course of action still then harboring some of the desires or the motivations from the first half of their life that might not necessarily be helpful in the second half?
That's a really good point. And again, that guest will know a lot more than me about the subject. What I would say from my own experience, and I'm someone who's on that kind of pathway through TRT to figure out whether or not I want to use it, because my testosterone is the same as a 70-year-old. And you'd be like, this guy just rode across an ocean. But like literally have my testosterone free test and total test is like off the scale low. And so I'm not being my optimal Mike. And that I resisted it for many years. You know, I was like, should I do this? Should I not? Oh, it's juicing. It's cheating. You know, it's not really you. But the more I think about it, the more I think, why would you not want to be optimal? You get one life. Why would you not want to feel great? Why would you not want to have a strong libido? Why would you not want to be able to go and move some weights around in the gym? Like, that is living, man. And that's not just in the first half. I think I'm not sure about, you know, the lack of testosterone, you know, helping men to become wise elders. You're still going to be wise because that's the experience you build over time. That's where wisdom really comes from. It's not just a hormonal thing. It's the experiences you've had. But if you could put the same drive that you had in the first half of your life into others, into your relationships, into your own personal health and well-being, life would be a way better place, man. So I keep that drive, just shift the focus away from money, power, status to relationships, health, friendships.
I guess it's having had that life experience and also some of the excess, you don't maybe need it as much, and that's going to allow you to do more of the other roles you've mentioned. I also just want to talk to you, Mike, really quickly about next 45, looking into your crystal ball. What do the next 5 or 10 years look like? Because you've obviously an ambitious guy. You're obviously an incredibly determined guy who can move mountains. What are you going to do over the next 5 or 10 years? Paint me a picture of what the business is going to look like and what contribution you're going to make to society.
So I'd like to think within the next 5 years, we will be the leading voice for men in midlife. I think we'd like to have started a conversation society about men. And I think we're going to see that. I can see that starting to shift now. And I hope that we've been in some way a catalyst to men being a bit more open and having that conversation. Certainly, I feel we were a little bit ahead of the curve when we started last year. As I've said earlier, we've started to see some other people in that space talking. I'd like to think our events are full. Like, we run the 100 every September for 100 guys. We're about half capacity at the moment, which is still an amazing achievement. 50 guys come in and, you know, spending some time on themselves for a weekend. I think that'll be full. And then we want to branch out and create a pathway for leaders specifically to support men who are still ambitious and running companies, and also fathers as well. So we want to do an event around fatherhood where you can bring your child with you and create some amazing memories and start to improve the life of those younger people as well. So I think we're very much just at the beginning. You know what it's like starting a business, Joe. We are just hustling. There's no one's getting paid. We're just working really, really hard. But I'd ask everyone to go to nxt45.com, sign up for our newsletter, The Journal. It's free Every single week you get insights on from Joe in psychology, from Johnny in sport nutrition, from myself in mindset, and just start to connect with others and share it.
What is the initial response when people discover you? Because I imagine there's a pent-up demand for this because there's not a ton of services, if any, offering this. Is the initial reaction from middle-aged guys like, where the hell have you been?
You get two reactions. That's one. And the other one is, I'm absolutely fine. And it's the guys who say they're absolutely fine. You're absolutely not fine, by the way. There's still that kind of protective mechanism that a lot of men have, particularly guys who've been successful on that first mountain. And they don't want to lose what they feel like they've got. And our kind of, my view of it is you're not losing it. You're just changing your focus a little bit. So there's those guys who put up the wall and, you know, we're not forcing anyone to do anything. You got to lean into this. We hope to change their viewpoint over time. And then there are guys that are like, man, I desperately need this. And we saw a few of those gentlemen come to the event last year. And like I said, it was life changing. And you said there's not a lot around. Like, I looked really hard for a few years to find something out there for men like this. And of course, you've got great organizations like Andy's Man Club, you've got Man Sheds and things like that bring men together. But they tend to be like a meet up for a cup of tea once a week and a chat, which is great. It's great. What we try and do with our app is connect people constantly. We put on real world events. We have online masterclasses with experts every month to try and give those tools and insights. So yeah, two types of responses, mate. And I'm hoping that we can bring everyone on board to start this conversation.
Thank you for listening to the Unfiltered podcast. If you've got this far, I hope you won't mind if I ask you to leave a 5-star review when you get the chance. We'd really appreciate it. And don't forget you can access all of our exclusive Unfiltered video interviews and features at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. See you next time.